This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Hebrews chapter 2, because it comes after chapter 1, and that's where we are and that's what we're doing. We are in the book of Hebrews. If you haven't been in it a little while, that's what we're doing. We're in the book of Hebrews. It's in the New Testament. It's a great book. It's a letter. We introed it and we talked all about it. And I'll keep going back to it and keep referring to it because, like I said last time, I want to keep the big picture. Always try to keep the big picture. Reminders to remember where we were, remember what this is about, so that when we come to a new chapter, we see, oh, yeah, I remember that. That's what that looks like. That's how that was. I remember that last time you talked. A lot of stuff has happened since then. A lot of days went by. But I sort of remember it. So if you sort of remember it, then we can go on to chapter 2. And let's read some of that now. We won't get to a lot of this, but we're going to read 4 verses. Chapter 2, Hebrews, and here it is for you. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard, while God also bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to His will. And this is God's Word. Hebrews chapter 2, the first few verses. We saw how the writer of this letter got right straight directly to the point. Couple of weeks when we looked at the opening section of this letter, how there wasn't a whole lot of that preliminary stuff that letters sometimes have. In fact, stuff that New Testament letters almost always have. There was no greeting, no formalities, no, you know, introductory stuff you're used to. He just got right into it. And when he got right into it, he got right to his point. Because he had a point and maintains a point throughout. And we saw what it was. In short, it was that Jesus, who is the Messiah, is a whole lot more even than the Messiah. That in fact, He's greater than just about anything and everything that they hold dear. He's superior. He surpasses it. He fulfills it. He completes it. And He's greater than it. Whatever it was and is. And of course, He's going to talk about a lot of those things that it is and was. About their life. About their religious life. The things that are important. He trumps all of those. He's better than all of those. And in fact, just to really put the fine point on it, as we saw last time, Jesus is, in fact, the imprint, he said. Remember that? The imprint, or the character, was the Greek word, of the very substance, the hypostasis, remember? Of God. A bold theological declaration that was. But that's what he said. He got right to his point. He said, that's what I'm saying here. And from there, of course, this will all be quite expounded and drawn out. And he'll give lots of examples and he'll articulate it more finely. Now, when we approach a text, which is what we do and what Christians have always done, we're very text-based. The church carries on a ministry of word and sacrament. I mean, we're tied to a written word. Why? Because writing is a beautiful thing. It preserves things. It maintains things. Writing puts it down, and it can get passed down, and it can get copied, and it can maintain a message. So we have in our hands what was written a long, long, long time ago, and very, very well preserved. Better than any other text, in fact. So that we got to learn how to read well. This is why literacy has always been attached to the church, and the church has been the champion of literacy, because we want and need people to read. We want them to. We want them to come to the text themselves. So when we're looking at the text from time to time, you know, I sort of give you little tips to help us become better readers. We want to be a people who are good readers of the Word, who are very literate in the Bible, and who know have the skills and the practice and the interpretive skills and experience to handle it well. That's part of maturity as a believer. You can handle the text well. You don't butcher it up and you know, misunderstand it, make it say a lot of things. So I hope that, you know, when we go through this and we care to give you principles and tips on what they call hermeneutics.
Herman who?
Yeah, it's sort of interpretation. It's a $2 word for interpretation. It's what you do basically with every text you read. You interpret it. You try to figure out what it means. No different here. But there are things you do to do that well, as opposed to doing it really poorly and coming up with all kinds of screwball ideas and doctrines and heresies and strange ideas that either you might do to suit yourself, or you might do just because you're confused and biblically illiterate and don't know how to do it. And to avoid that, a lot of times what Christians do is they're just afraid. They say, I can't read this, I'll mess it up. Why, I'm not a scholar enough. Why, I don't understand it enough, I'll probably get it wrong. What's the point of me trying to read this and understand this? I just can't. It's old, it's difficult. But hopefully, and my prayer is, that we all gain increasingly more and more confidence to do it. Because we can do it well. All right. So, one point for today then. One tip. One thing we can glean from this. When you're reading any text that is not a story or a song, anything that's, I would say nonfiction, but it's more than that. Anything that's non-narrative, it's not, you know, it's not a story being told or not a poem or a song or just a saying like of the Proverbs. Anything that is straight ahead text, like the letters are, like certain messages within the narratives, you get sermons and speeches and narrative. This applies to those. When you read those, you should always learn to look for the argument, to spot an argument. What do I mean by that? To spot when somebody's trying to make a case for something. To be able to tell that somebody's trying to convince me of something right here. Somebody has a main point, they're trying to persuade me of it. Arguments like that, in that sense, are everywhere. There's arguments used in another sense, too. There's more than one kind of argument, and they're both everywhere, frankly. The kind of argument that's sort of like what you should not do, you know, the kind your kids do on a long trip in the back seat until it drives you nuts and you pull over the car, and you put it in park, and you start throwing hands. I'm sorry, some of you do that. Of course, I never would. But some of you, maybe, who don't have the control of a person like me, you might, you know. But you know what I'm saying. That's arguing, and that's another definition that sort of came later. And we're not talking about that. Well, I'm talking about an argument in the classical definition of it, the sense that in the academic sphere. This is the sense in which you see it displayed or acted out in courtrooms, mostly on TV, when someone has what? An opening argument. An argument is just, you're making a case for something. There's something that you believe, there's a claim you want to make, there's an opinion that you have, and you want to show why you think it's true and right, so you're going to be persuasive and say, look, here's what I think, here's how I think it is, here's the case that I want to make, now let me tell you why I think it. Let me show you why I think it's true and why you should believe it. That's an argument. It's all over the place, all the time. People are making arguments all the time. They may not know it, and they may not say they are, but they are. All of the opinion makers of today, all the people on the TV, all the columnists who write their stuff, even people really, even sometimes even through the arts, I said that that's not where you find them, but you do find them there. There are creative ways to slip an argument in, you know, when you're telling a story. I mean, Hollywood does this all the time. They have a case that they want to make, and they want to convince you of it, so they tell you a good story. And in it, they'll make their case for why you ought to believe like they believe. Well, arguments are everywhere then. You do it, everybody does it. We don't often know we do it, and often we don't do it very well. So we do a poor job. We make bad arguments. You should learn, by the way, just in general, not just approaching the Bible, but just generally, you should learn. We all should learn better and better how to identify arguments being made all around us. How to read a news story correctly and say, I see what you're trying to do there. I see you're trying to make a case for something. It's good to see that because not everyone knows they're doing it or not everyone wants to be very forthright about it. I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I heard somebody talking and they were making an argument. They didn't say they were, they didn't use that word, and they didn't lay it out technically like it was, but they were. This was somebody talking about how, they were making the case that some people shouldn't be allowed to speak in certain places. Like, shouldn't be invited to places to speak, their opinions are no good, we shouldn't let them. And they were arguing, they were having this little back and forth debate thing with somebody who was kind of saying, yeah, but the First Amendment and freedom of speech. And this person was saying, I don't know if you're aware of this today, but there's a faction of people today that are increasingly saying, you know, that First Amendment, I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, maybe that's overrated, First Amendment. Because this liberty of speech and religion, which is essentially what the First Amendment is, that annoys me sometimes. It really annoys me sometimes that people can say stuff that I don't like. And there are people today who are saying, maybe we should rethink that amendment. Maybe freedom of speech, you know, shouldn't be extended. Well, this person wanted to say that because some people shouldn't be invited to speak in certain places. And here's what the person said, and I've heard this before. There's an argument here, okay? They didn't say, I will now make an argument, and here's my argument, and let me give it to you as an argument. What they said was, I can't help it. I have to put it in the form of an argument, because I sized it up, and that's what I saw. But here's what the argument would look like. You could say, the first part of the argument would be, speech that dehumanizes, or speech that takes away someone's humanity, this is the way they put it, is terrible and should not be allowed. There should not be freedom of a person whose speech, the things they say, dehumanizes or takes away someone's full humanity. That's what they were saying. And their second part of it was, this particular speaker, person X, whoever was invited to speak, holds opinions that takes away the humanity of some people. Therefore, they shouldn't be allowed to speak. Now, they didn't put it, in technical terms like that, but you see, there was an argument there. They were, because their main claim was, so-and-so shouldn't get to talk. Should have to stay home, keep his mouth shut. Shouldn't get a microphone, shouldn't be invited anywhere. My reason for saying that was, and those were the two reasons. That was the case they're being built. Now, what happens when you see an argument? You should analyze it. You should try to fairly critique it. Is it true? Is it a good argument? It didn't take me more than about 4 seconds to recognize that this was one terrible argument. One very bad argument. Why? Well, I don't have a whole lot of time to belabor this, but just as a teaching tool here. Because, look, I considered both of the claims here that are supposed to support the main claim. Speech that dehumanizes shouldn't be allowed. Well, first of all, what is speech that dehumanizes? I can tell you right now, the person that they were talking about in this case was not saying that anyone was any less than human. Had never said that. Had never said those words. In fact, I'm not sure out there today who runs around saying that this group of people is less than human. I mean, some people in history have said that. I mean, maybe I guess the Nazis sort of ranked the Jews a little lower than you fully human, you know. And sometimes during the age of slavery, some people made that kind of a case. I mean, in some of the worst, basically, some of the worst episodes of atrocities, that was often involved. Because that's one way that you justify terrible things, you dehumanize people. So, yeah, it's not like nobody has ever said that. But I'm not sure who today on the scene is running around saying that someone is less than fully human. Now, some of you might say, hey, there are some people that believe that until you emerge from the womb, you're not completely human. Maybe so. That may be part of the argument that some people are making. But certainly the people that are being disinvited and not getting allowed to speak today because of that are never saying that group X is less than human. So that's the question there, who's even saying it? But let's just assume they were. What if there was a group today saying, I believe that all people from Poland, or all left-handed people, you name it, any class of, are not fully human. Would the First Amendment not apply to them? I mean, legally speaking, I don't see why not. Is it Would it be a strange view? Yeah. Would it be a true view? I don't think so. Would it be an unpopular view? Well, surely. Would it be a view that would probably upset people in that category? Yeah, I would imagine if someone has the view that all people born in Poland are not fully human, and I'm born in Poland, I'm not going to like that view. But the First Amendment would still apply. They still can say it. they still get to say it because they're not physically harming anybody born in Poland. See what I mean? So that first premise they made was bad. And then, of course, the second one was that person was in fact saying that, and that person was not saying that. All that person was doing was expressing an opinion they didn't care for, that they disagreed with, that doesn't go along with the main thing. Why did I tell you all that? This is an example. That's one little example of one thing I heard this week, and in it I identified an argument being made, and I was able to see that this is a bad argument. That's a good practice to develop in your mind. Learn how to do that. Learn how to do that. And likewise, we don't just use it as a weapon, by the way, against anyone that I'm against. We use it again. We use that same practice with the Bible writers. I want to see their argument too. I want to understand what's being said. The writer of Hebrews is doing that very thing, as Paul often does in many places. Is that you have these arguments. In fact, in Hebrews, we see a lot of sub-arguments. Like, for example, we'll see places where he makes the case that Jesus is the ultimate high priest, greater than them, and where he's the ultimate sacrifice, greater than the other sacrifices, and, he's higher than the angels and so on. Those are sub-arguments, but they all serve the big argument, because the entire letter of Hebrews, in a sense, is one giant argument for the claim he set up front. Which, by the way, is a good way to do that. I always like that, by the way. When you're in school, did you ever have to write one of those argument papers? Or argument essays or something? And they'd always tell you, now when you do this one, kids, what do? You put your main thesis up front. State it first. Because you go up, what you're doing there is, the style of it is that you're not, it's not a mystery. You're not guiding him along and then revealing at the end what your conclusion is. Since you're making a case, you go ahead and say up front, here's what I'm about to argue for this point right here. Are you ready? I'm about to show you why. That's how you do it. The writer of Hebrews then is keeping this that style perfectly when right out of the gate he just hits you with the main point of the whole letter, but then explores it and there are a lot of subpoints. In fact, Hebrews almost could have opened up by saying something like, in the following letter, I shall be defending the proposition that. And that would sound a little formalized, but he almost could have done that, because that's sort of what's going on. So, we want to identify arguments, case of being made for something, and understand it, and assess it. Now, all that being said, here we are, though, starting off with the second chapter, where, in fact, he kind of pivots and transitions out of the main argument here for a second. Because while the letter to the Hebrews could be seen as a grand argument being made, it's not merely an argument. In other words, it's not just a treatise design. It's still a letter to human beings. It's still a letter to the Christian believers. So it's going to have personal elements and pastoral elements. And by the way, this pivot right here at the beginning of chapter 2 is why it was a good idea for the people that inserted the chapters to go ahead and do a chapter break right there. I know you're aware that the chapters were not originally in the letters, because nobody originally writes a letter and puts chapter headings and verses in it. Do you? Right? What if all your emails, you start your email with chapter 1,
verse 1.
Wouldn't that be great, like love letters, guys would be sending to, chapter 1, verse 1, from Jimmy, or whatever, Jimmy, I'm sorry, I'm just pick Jimmy, an epistle unto Sally, grace and peace unto you, and what up, girl, anyway, so, it wouldn't be, that's not how you would write a letter. You wouldn't put, and then verse 2. Do you want to hang out? Verse 3. That's not how you write. You don't put chapter and verse in your own letters or in stories you tell. You don't open up you know, I mean, well, I want to get away from that. So, why they're there? What? You're telling me that's not inspired? I mean, it's inspired in a lesser sense. Some really, you know, really good, smart, qualified Christian leaders once upon a time decided, let's do this. But it's not inspired in the true divine sense. A chapter break or a verse could have been worked out a little bit differently, and there would have been no loss to the meaning of the text. Why are they there? They're there because throughout the years, Christians have so treasured and prized this word that they want to, if you will, catalog every section and piece of it. And so it's for reference purposes that you have chapter and verse. They're not original. Reference purposes. But there are logical places to change chapter. And this, in Hebrews, was a very logical place for a chapter break. Because he's switching. You know another way I know he's doing a little transitional pivot? Therefore! Because you don't just launch into a letter with therefore right out of the gate. Now, sometimes in colloquial English, the way we talk, we will begin sentences with a transitional word like that. I don't know how often people will, you haven't seen them and you haven't had any words with them, and they'll begin talking to you by saying, so, like, so the thing, you know, it's like, the word so traditionally was one of those kind of transitional, like it connects two ideas, but we just lead with it. But that's just, just one of those little habits of English that came along. But it's particularly in the letters and when you're reading the Bible, these are connecting points. He's saying, okay now. I mean, he came out from the start, guns blazing, laying all this heavy doctrine on you about who is Christ, his greatness, his supremacy, how he is one with God, the very character of God's nature, and blah, blah, and all that. And then, he hits you with all that. Now, in light of that, he's going to get more personal and bring it down and say, okay, now in light of that, that being said, now let me give you something. And what he's going to give you now is what we would call, and here's a good Bible word for you, an admonition. An admonition. He will now admonish, which is just, you know, one of those words I happen to like. Admonish is a word that people still use. I don't just mean in church. In church, if you were raised in church, you know what admonish means and you know what an admonition is. And if you're a Bible reading person, you certainly know what it is. But I would say that even outside of the church, people still use the word, don't they? Admonish, they sometimes use it. And of course, it's used directly in the Bible. And it's done a lot, even when it's not, even when the word isn't there, there's a lot of admonition going on. What is an admonition? It has to do with urging you towards something, encouraging you towards something, reminding you of something, trying to exhort you to something, and the sharpest edge of it, okay, is like a rebuke. An admonition can kind of have a more positive tone, like, come on, I want to encourage you to do this. And it can also have a little darker tone, like, you really better do this. And as we'll see next time, there's a warning with this admonition. We won't have time for that today. There's an admonition here, and there's a warning that comes with it. And we'll save the warning until next time. Here we're looking at the admonition. This is where he pivots here. So therefore, in light of this, I want to urge you towards something. I want to admonish you towards something. The root word of the word for admonition is the word nous, the word for mind. It has to do with I'm gonna put something back in your mind. I want to help get your mind shifted back. I want to remind you. The mind is a leaky, leaky vessel. Amen. Is yours? It's full of holes. You can't keep stuff in it very well. It's hard to keep stuff organized in it. It's all like convoluted. And some of you are going, yeah. Try getting my age. Yeah, I know. There's a sort of like ascending ladder of descending memory. Okay, it's just sort of like, sorry, kids, but the way the flow chart works on this is as your years are going up, the old mind skills can start to go down. What's that? What'd you say? Who? Where? What? Can't remember. And this just happens to all of us. So what do we read over and over and over again throughout the Bible is reminders. The emphasis on reminding. You go back to the old covenant and they're always saying, keep the law. Write it down. Put it on your forehead. Put it on the doors, posts. Tell your kids. Tell them again. Remind them again. You should recite it. Recite it at the, you know, at the entryway. Okay, when just say it, write it down, try to stick it in your memory. Because you will forget stuff. And you will drift away. And you'll slide off over here. You forgot all about. You got to keep being reminded. You've got to keep coming back to these things over and over again. Every time when we take communion, we remember that Jesus said to remember. Keep doing this. Why? Because I want you to remember the main point here. I am dying here. My body will be broken for you. So why don't you do this repeatedly in remembrance? Because you'll forget. You'll start thinking that the church is about something else that it's not really about. You know, you'll relocate the main focus of this thing over here to some other cause and some other emphasis that's not the main emphasis. So do this to remember this. So here he says, his main exhortation then is that therefore, he says, you need to pay attention. See that? That's the main verb there. To pay attention and to pay closer attention. There's even more emphasis on it. The main verb of this clearly is this verb for to pay attention. And then what happens is, in the Greek, now there's this little adverb that's with it. So it's not just pay attention, it's, as it says there, pay closer attention. Well, adverb adds the emphasis. The Holman Bible says, pay even more attention. The King James says, give the more earnest heed. I like that. Give the more earnest heed to it. We don't use heed anymore, right? You must heed the word. I mean, I do, but I'm weird like that. You must heed it. The old English Bible, the Douay-Rheims, which was the Catholic English Bible, translated it like this. It said, therefore you ought more diligently to observe. You know, you could paraphrase this for us today by saying something like, don't lose your focus. How often you say that? You say that to your kids sometimes? Focus! Come on, you got to focus. Focus like a laser beam. You got to focus. It's harder to focus today, I think, than it used to be. It's always been a little hard to focus, but I think now it's even harder to focus. The world's making it harder to focus with every new iPhone. You know what I mean? They just get better and faster and give me more stuff to make it hard for me to focus. So you could say that, or you could say, keep your eye on the ball. Come on now, over here, keep your eye on the ball. Don't forget. That's what he's saying. You've got to pay better and closer attention. He is giving the admonition to us. We are being admonished to do this, to pay closer attention because, or so that, why? Why? What's the harm? What's the potential here? So that we don't drift, it says. We don't drift away. Drift away from what? From what we've heard is what he says. We don't drift away from what we've heard. What he means, of course, he's referring to the whole thing, the entirety of the message, the entire Christian message, the truth about things, the faith once and for all delivered to the saints. He says you can just drift right away from it. Notice the difference between just drifting away and suddenly falling completely away from it. It's not so abrupt. The thing to worry about isn't that one day you wake up with total amnesia of everything that you've learned, or that you just completely walk away from it all in one decision. That does happen for some people. They just say, I'm done with this. I don't believe this anymore. I'm out. That happens sometimes. But for every one of those, there's like 500 people who don't do that. They just slowly move away. They just slowly inch away with the current. They never woke up and made a cognitive decision. I'm not part of that. I don't believe this anymore. I will not live according to this word anymore. They never did that. They just slowly... Well, why'd that happen? Because you drift. You will inevitably find yourself adrift. You don't pay attention for a month, 6 months, then a year, then 3 or 4 years. You're not paying attention. You're never in the Word. You're never around those Christians that you used to kind of have the fellowship with. You're kind of just coming into church once in a while. And guess what? 3 years from now, You're so far out adrift, you can't see land anymore. You're not sure. Your compass doesn't work. You're like, what? You never made the decision consciously. You made it sort of unconsciously or subconsciously or just by negligence. You neglected, which is why the warning we'll look at says, we should not neglect so great a thing as this. This is a compound word then, this word for drift. And as is often the case, I told you in Hebrews, you got a lot of unique vocabulary here. This word for to drift in Hebrews is not used anywhere else in the New Testament. Its only use is right here in this verse. And it's a compound word. And by the way, almost every English translation just says drift. It's sort of, oddly, the King James is sort of different on this one. It says, lest at any time we should let them slip. Talking about these things we have heard, shouldn't let them slip. But drift is actually the better translation on this one, because that is what this word means. It's a compound word, and the main root of it has to do with to float, to glide or flow as with a current. So it would be used literally like that. But then what happens is you get this little preposition on it, the word para that you see in a lot of words, which sort of means to float or drift away. Not just to drift, but to drift out, to drift away. Because it's not an innocent drifting. You're not drifting alongside. You get away. So the Greek writers outside the New Testament, because that's the only thing we have to go on, because no one else uses it in the New Testament. But outside the New Testament, Greek writers would use it sometimes literally, like you're really drifting on water. But more often than not, it was a metaphorical kind of symbolic use to mean something that gets lost, something that you can't find, something that sort of like somehow got away from you. And in fact, they say that writers like Sophocles is cited on this, Plato, they would use this same word that the writer of Hebrews uses to refer to something that they forgot, that they couldn't remember. As in, it slipped away from my mind. It sort of drifted out of my mind and I forgot it. Which, by the way, is perfect, because that's exactly what he's talking about here. And so let's just consider the two options here, the juxtaposition between the thing you're admonished to do, pay attention, stay focused, versus drifting off and drifting away. It's a perfect metaphor, this whole idea of being in the current and drifting off. It's ideal, because the fact is we exist in a culture that has current. In fact, it has a lot of small currents, but all those currents and riptides and undercurrents and all that stuff, they're all kind of moving one general way. Anybody ever been in strong currents before? If you don't appreciate the power of water when its volume is enough or when its current is strong enough, then you know you ought to acquaint yourself with it, although wear a life jacket, okay?
Yeah.
But you know, it's really amazing when the first time you learn to respect the power of water. This can happen on some beaches. Bunch of landlocked people, bunch of prairie dwellers like you guys. We've all gone off to the coast. Remember that first time? you're not a beach person. And you're like, yay, the beach. And you went out there and, whoa, the water kind of moves funny. I mean, I'm not talking about the stuff I see coming. I see all that water coming in, crashing in, coming at me. But there's this other powerful force pulling back out. And you'd be warned. Weren't you warned as a kid? Be careful now for that undercurrent, right? Yeah, you got those other currents flowing back. And I don't know if this has ever happened to any of you. You got out there. I was a dumb kid. I was a daredevil. So I was like, woohoo, I'm a good swimmer. And like, the next thing I knew, I was way out further than I ever thought. How'd I get out here? Why is the shore way over there? And then I realized it's kind of hard to get back. This water is not letting me get back. Of course, if you don't watch out, then you panic. But why does that happen? You're not appreciating that amount of water coming back. Well, even better, of course, is a river. Now, we have nice flowing streams around here. Nice, wonderful. People go on, quote, float trips. And that's an appropriate word for them. But out in some other places, the water is not as friendly. And it's a daredevil's game. And of course, you know, living out west like we did, so several times I've been out on what's called the Snake River, this thing running through Idaho. Now David knows what I'm talking about. And there are parts of that that are fairly brutal. In fact, deadly. In fact, not to be grim, but people drown in it every single year. It just happens. Because the power of the water must be respected. And even if you're a great swimmer, and even if you have a life raft, I'll tell you, the closest I ever came to death was in that river, no doubt about it. Because we got out on it, and it was extra snow melt, and there was more volume of water even than usual. And we were just too dumb to realize, hey, maybe this is going to be a little more dangerous than normal. We all jumped on. This is a tough raft, too. One of those big river raft. And everyone was like, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. Everyone, well, I should give credit where it's due. My wife did say, you know, maybe this is not a great idea this year. Because no one else is on it. Why is no one else on this river right now? Why are we the only ones here right now? What's going on here? Well, we were just like, hey, it's fun. We're already here. We got a raft. Let's go. Because, you know, we're good swimmers. We've done this before. That thing absolutely spanked us and sent us to our room. In fact, I mean, you know, it took our lunch money. It did everything wrong and cruel and mean to us. It destroyed the raft. I mean, we had to drag it out and drag it back, deflate it. It threw everybody off. And I thought I was going to die. Because I went into that water without the full appreciation for the sheer power of it. I had those river shoes on, you know, that you wear. It sucked them right off. And as I saw the surface getting further away, I felt the life jacket trying to come off me. I'm trying to hold it on, and I'm trying to fight it. And I, of course, somehow I remembered people saying, don't try to swim against that, you idiot. You can't. You got to go limp. So, I mean, I was already out of gas anyway. Because all it takes is about 8 seconds of fighting that kind of water, and you're out of energy. I mean, like it'll take your energy just in the span of 10 seconds of fighting that hard. So I just went with it, and I thought, okay, this may be it for me, because I don't know if I'm coming back up. I don't know what's gonna happen. But then suddenly, before I knew it, they threw me back up to the top, and I was like, wait, I don't know. I was half a mile from where I'd gone in, and From that point on, you know, I had a renewed and very healthy reverence for the power of water and current. Well, the culture then, this is the analogy, is like a current. It's moving along, and it just takes everybody with it. And if you're not paying attention, you're just in it. You're just drifting with it. You're just floating with it. And you may not know it necessarily. In fact, a lot of people, I think, don't notice how strong it is because they've never tried to stand against it before. And if you're just riding on top of it and you never went in it, you don't know how strong it is. You haven't tried to stand against it. Well, when we're in it then, it's sort of like, you know, you can fool yourself into not realizing how powerful it is. I guess a good analogy here is, you know, if you're on a giant ship and you're way up on the top decks, it may feel like that ship's not going very fast, right? It's like it's just barely cruising. But if you could go down right by where the actual level of the water is against the ship, you would realize the speed at which it's actually traveling, right? You would see it. I mean, even better is an airplane. When you're at cruising altitude, an airplane kind of feels like it's just going along nice and slow in the air. You know, because the ground just crawls beneath you real slow. But if you suddenly for a split second could be 10 feet off the ground at that same speed, you would immediately realize just how fast you're really going. Well, see, we don't realize the speed at which the culture moves and that we're in that current. You know, we spent those weeks looking at the pattern of thinking in the world. Remember that? The pattern of thinking in the world. And that's what I'm talking about. All together, all of those ideas together form part of the specific current that we're in. Everybody thinks this way. And if you're not paying attention, guess what you will do? You will just think that way. Why wouldn't you? You're going to go where the current takes you if you're just floating on it. Just as sure as the law of physics dictate that anything floating will go where the current goes, so in some ways the law of minds and beliefs and worldview and social influence and all that stuff will also dictate that if you don't try or you're not focused, or you're not paying attention to it, or you're not thinking about it, or you're just being a casual passenger of life, then wherever the cultural current goes, that's where you'll go. Some of you wonder sometimes, you look at the way, circumstances today, the opinions of people, the way they think, and you think, how did this happen? Some of you, especially a little bit older, you think, how did this happen? How have people come to think like this? And the answer is, the giant river of culture just carried everybody. Everybody eventually just ended up going along. And the people that stand against it have to be pretty sure-footed, because the current will abuse you a little if you stand against it. And it's not easy to do. The writer of Hebrews knows that this is not easy. And this constant, I would even argue that it's even harder today, that the circumstances of today, the constant information, all the million opinions at once, you're exposed to 10,000 opinions every day. You scroll them, right? This opinion, this opinion, this opinion, this opinion. Someone is outraged. Someone's upset. Someone says this. Someone believes that. Someone's declaring this. Someone claims that. Here's a meme. Here's a thing. Here's a whatever. It's just, right? You just scroll through it, and everybody under the sun's opinion is everywhere. But we've never been more aware of every single person's opinion. If some inane thing happens this afternoon, like somebody somewhere does something that's in the public eye, it can be even fairly innocuous and something that would have hardly moved the needle. But guess what will happen now? 1 million tweets will be fired off into the air and land on 1 billion phones. And suddenly everyone will be sitting when they could be doing something more productive, and they'll be scrolling 100,000 people's opinions. Here's what this one says. Here's what this one says. Here's what this person says. Of course, they'll all sound mostly the same. Because again, everyone's going to just say, the thing to say. They're all in the same current. A few people might go against the current and say something that doesn't go along with everyone else. At which point, 10,000 nasty, ugly, vicious tweets will be fired at them. Because how dare they not go along with the current? See what I mean? So this is hard to do. And we all feel the tide of popular opinion at all times around us. Like we're standing in a river, it's constantly pushing you. You feel the pressure of it all around you. Conform. Conform to the pattern of the world. Go with this current. Stop fighting it. Agree, agree, agree. Affirm, affirm, affirm. Say what we like. Don't say what you think is true. Say what we say is true. Go with the current. Go with the flow. Think like this. You'd better. If so, we'll leave you alone. We'll leave your church alone. You can do your thing. We'll say good for you. This is hard for us to do. Now, of course, aside from just the forces of culture that are like this, I mean, I think there's also just the other, there's just the usual boredom. There's just entertainment. You can drift not so much with the main strength of the current of culture. You can also just drift around lost in a swirling eddy off to the side, like a little tide pool over to the side, where you just basically, your brain just vegetates on nonsense. There's a lot of people like that today. They don't really have many beliefs about anything. They don't know what they think about anything. They just know what the next episode is that there's on the 45 shows they are simultaneously streaming this week. That's all they know. They got no view of anything else. They just lost. They're lost in 45,000 streams of entertainment. That's another way to drift. You can drift along with wrong opinions and falsehoods and error, but you can also just drift off into nonsense and blasé, blandness and boredom, where basically, in some ways, you're like the people that are lost at sea in the old days. navigators would hate the idea of getting out somewhere where the wind would absolutely stop and they couldn't move because they depended on wind to get anywhere. So if you got outside of those streams of wind in the early days of navigation, it could be deadly. It's like the old rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, you know. It could be death out on an open ocean with no wind. It could be deadly and a slow, terrifying way to die because you're going to die of thirst and go mad, right? And, you know, that is another way, I think, to go. You can just get yourself out into nowhere where you're just out there. Nothing productive goes in your mind. So all of this we must avoid. All of this. This is our admonition.
So whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if they're being heard, you know, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and never man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.